Hi, this is Damien O'Doherty with the Lobby Podcast at Center Maryland. We're extremely grateful today to have the senator from the 47th legislative district. We all know there are 47 legislative districts, so that's a special numeral there. He's Senator Malcolm Augustine from Prince George's County. Welcome, Senator. Thanks for coming back.
Damien, thank you so much for having me.
Every time we do these, you know, I roll through the Maryland manual and I check out folks' Twitter feeds. But for you, I just got this gorgeous family picture sent to my text, a holiday card from you. And I said, that was one of the nicest interviews I've ever had. I got to have that guy on to kick off the new year and start this with the right tone. So welcome.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. And happy new year.
You are, I call Montgomery County the big county, but Prince George's County for me is really Maryland's showcase county. You got so much going on there. I'd love to hear, you know, your point of view about what's going on in Prince George's County this day. What's going right? What are some things you might need to tinker with? We've seen so much fabulous growth, attention, and integrity in that part of the state. I think people just want to learn more about what's going on there.
Damien, thank you. And I appreciate the way that you, the sort of the framing that you gave to your comments. I'm grateful for that because that's not always the way that people frame Prince George's County. In fact, Damien, this is actually one of the reasons I got into politics, actually, is that I felt that, you know, many times Prince George's County is painted with a less than favorable brush, and that it really wasn't necessarily entirely fair, quite honestly. We are a diverse county. We are a county with absolutely tremendous resources. We have tremendous potential, which I'm just so very proud of. Our location, so close to the nation's capital, having tremendous transportation resources, public transportation opportunities. I represent, my area includes the New Carrollton Metro Station, for example. And the New Carrollton Metro Station is unique in our region, in that it has Metro, WMATA, Metro is there. You have the bus there. You have, you've got Amtrak there. You have connections less than 20 miles to BWI Airport, less than 20 miles to DCA, right here in Prince George's County. Just a tremendous opportunity. And we have seen unbelievable investment that has paid off for those who have in Prince George's County over the last decade. And I think the future remains very bright.
Yeah, it's interesting to me, like when I started my firm maybe 13 years ago or 15 years ago, whatever it was, you know, you think about the metro sites that were hotly talked about. You think like White Flint, and then you look at White Flint today, it really hasn't shifted or changed. They got the great Jake Weissman over there. It's going to fix all that and change all that. I remember New Carrollton sort of being this, as you said, convergence of transit stops, but with not much else there. Can you talk a little bit about what's happening there? Or what one of those Baltimore train passengers might see that might get them to stop off at New Carrollton this time because there's a change?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Love to talk about that. So Damien, before I came to the legislature, I was on the WMATA board of directors and
worked. No good deed goes unpunished.
Yeah,
no good deed goes unpunished.
Yeah, but you know what's interesting though, Damien? This goes back to sort of like why I'm in these things. I looked at our metro sites, particularly from a development standpoint, and I just saw tremendous potential that wasn't happening. And New Carrollton was actually one of them. And at the time, I was working with WMATA trying to peel away some of the barriers to development that were occurring at that particular site. some of them were real. So WMATA had this requirement for garages that they be built to a certain standard. It was a 50-year standard, which just made development projects not feasible. Like, they just couldn't pay for themselves, particularly given that the industry at the time was only requiring a 30-year, that basically that was the industry standard at the time, was a 30-year garage. And so I asked them at WMATA at the time, you know, because people just said, well, it has to be that way. And I said, well, why? I mean, and it was simply a practice. It was not a policy. And so what do? We changed it. We changed that policy. And we
that's the difference between fresh eyes that you bring from the business sector and Harvard and all those places that you've been. And then somebody who's been around the block and just immediately hears a phrase, whether it's New Carrollton or WMATA, and puts a certain label on it, and puts it in a box. You're changing all that.
Try my very best to do so. And the great news is that when we did that, when we removed some of those barriers, it opened the door to new, fresh investment at New Carrollton, which brought a new East Coast hub for Kaiser Permanente at New Carrollton. It brought an addition of a beautiful new apartment complex that is there on both sides of the New Carrollton Metro stop. You also, if you look there now, WMATA looked to diversify where its basically headquarters are, and they chose the New Carrollton site to build their Maryland headquarters, in essence. Beautiful. The future is very, very bright at New Carrollton. And of course, folks are excited about the fact that the Purple Line, which I did not mention, will also, once we kind of get there, it's taking some time, of course, will terminate at New Carrollton, which will also then be a wonderful connection between Prince George's County and Montgomery County. So lots of great things. The thing I love to see, the cranes are there, you know, lots of bustling activity is happening at New Carrollton.
We've got a new train station on the way up in Baltimore. And one of those really unique spots in all of Maryland where some big things could happen is that line between Baltimore and New Carrollton, from Penn Station to New Carrollton. I'd love to see it come in the other way, right? I think that could be a likely scenario where we might be able to attract some folks up like Senator Augustine and WMATA and others to come up to Baltimore, check out what's going on there. And then you could tell us everything you got right so we don't make those mistakes up in Baltimore with this new elaborate transit center that we're going to have at Penn Station. Talk to me about this is your first term in office. You have a really strong breadth of experience all across the board, whether it's public service or business or faith. But this is a new experience for you, a re-election. I'd like to know what you're walking into there and what your eyes wide open see.
So it's a new experience for re-election. But it is not a new experience for me in the sense that I ran for office in 2014 and lost. And
you and me delegates. Both. Sorry.
What was that?
I say you and me both. I think a lot of Democrats in 2014 had a tough year in Maryland.
So. Yeah. Well, for me, I'm in Prince George's County. It wasn't a Democrat thing or whatever else the case may be. I mean, the reality was that it was, I raised my hand because, as we talked about, I felt like I wanted to provide some leadership in the area where I lived. And I had some ideas about what I thought I would want to do and everything else. And I went and pitched that to my neighbors and they told me it wasn't my time. They were just like, hey, you know, we like your ideas. We like what you're talking about. But quite honestly, we haven't seen or observed that you have done those things. And I took that to heart, Damien. I believed it. I could not argue with that. And so given that understanding and that experience in 2014, I just never stopped working on this community engagement, working on behalf of the people of District 47 from 2014 on. And so while this is my first reelection as the state senator who represents the people of District 47, I've just not changed my level of engagement from 2014 when I promised the people. I went and I told them, I mean it. I'm not going to go away because, Damien, I know you've seen this. You've always seen the bright, shiny candidate comes in. They say great things. You know, the people know how that works, right? And if they don't, if they're not successful, they disappear. They're gone, right? They move away or they do something else and everything else after the promises that they made. I really took that to heart.
That's right. They want to go. Person. They want to see you. They want to see you go from promise to purpose.
There
right?
You go. That's it. Exactly right. Exactly right. And so I've worked hard to stay focused on that. And so I continue to work hard with my, you know, with my constituents every day in order to just maintain that promise. And with the hope that they will reward me with giving me an opportunity to work on their behalf for another 4 years.
Now, do you run on a ticket that, like, what are the mechanics of down there? Make it sound like it's so far away. Talk to me about what the mechanics are like in Prince George's County for running for re-election for a Senate seat. Do you build a team? Is there a ticket? How does that work these days?
You know, historically, folks have done that. And it is also the case that I am working closely with the members of the General Assembly who are in the House of Delegates, Delegate Fennell, Delegate Ivy. We are a team. And so we are absolutely running for re-election together. Now, Delegate Juanika Fisher has chosen to run for a different office. And so she, and so we have an open seat that is there. And, you know, right now though, Damien, myself and Delegate Ivy and Delegate Fennell, we're focused on serving the people of 47 and then asking for their support in this upcoming election. That's where we are right now.
So promise, purpose, and then there's another P, which is maybe the work product or the progress that you've made. It seems like it just seems to me you have a sensibility about public service where it's not a competitive experience, although we all know it is. But the verbs I would use for you is just sort of offering yourself up to your community with that purpose, and let them decide. But we all know you're strong and powerful down there, which comes with another set of complexities, which that means that everybody that's running for the attorney general, everybody that's running for comptroller, everybody that's running for governor of the state, they want to know what Senator Malcolm Augustine and his constituents of the 47th district think. I would bet you they want to know more about what your district thinks than most any other district in the state. Talk to me about how you're managing those complications or opportunities.
Well, it is exactly what you've just said. Listen, I talk to everybody. First of all, I mean, I often share that, you know, governing is a team sport, no matter what, it's a team sport. And so I'm always looking to introduce people to District 47, get them a chance to see what we have, what our needs are, what our wants and desires are. And I just have continued to do that with all of the people who have, you know, expressed an interest in running for statewide office. So that has been my approach thus far. And again, to just really stay focused on helping to be cognizant of the needs of the folks in District 47. And then also to just also try my very best to stay focused as well on the role as a member of the Senate Finance Committee and in governing on behalf of the 6 million Marylanders, and just to not lose track or sight of that. Given the fact that we are in the midst of an election year. I mean, we still have, as you well know, we still have another session here. That's in right. front of us.
You got 25% of your votes left, right?
Yeah, there you go. And we have got a lot to work on, Damian, and we need everybody to just be, at full strength and thinking those things through as we're dealing with this global pandemic, and all the things that have come along with it. It's just, I'm doing my very best to stay focused as well on that, and just, not losing track of this tremendous responsibility that I have, that I do take it as a responsibility to do what's right and what's best for the people of Maryland.
How did your hospitals and healthcare facilities hold up through the Omicron variant thus far?
It is a struggle. My neighbors, many, many, many of them are on the front line, essential workers. It's one of the real challenges, actually, again, for me at least, of this position that they don't tell you about, which is the amount of loss that, my neighbors come to share with me as their representative, to see if there's something I could do to help with those things. And I really do, I take it very seriously. And as I mentioned, we have a tremendous number of frontline workers. We previously were the home to Prince George's County Hospital Center. It is now, that facility is now moved to Largo, but the people who work there still are my neighbors. And it's been hard. It's been hard. We've worked hard to try to get some additional resources in for particularly healthcare workers. And we'll keep doing that. I know that I was pleased to see that there is an investment by the governor in healthcare workers, and I'm supportive of that. And we're going to keep working hard to do that, because it has been a very, very challenging time. It was challenging before Omicron. Like, Omicron is just like on top of it all. We just are really in a crisis. We're in a crisis of the people who work in our healthcare system. They are they're also just in a mental health crisis, Damian. I mean, it's an acute situation for sure.
Yeah. And it's, like you're saying, your neighbors, it's community wide, and they come to you with this unsettling burden that you can understand for sure, and that you want to help, but how do you keep the resilience up in your public role to match the resilience of your neighbors that keep going back to work every day through three different strains of this virus, and who knows what's next to come?
It's really challenging. I mean, it is.
But I think is it you dig yourself, you like dig into the work? Is that what keeps you straight?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it's really challenging. But then, the times when we are able to help people, I mean, folks are being foreclosed on, but if I'm able to, and I have been able to help some people to stay in their homes, I mean, that buoys me. You know what I'm saying, Damian?
That's a great description too, because I kept saying to Mohan, when I see it, I keep saying he's a long distance swimmer, the head of the University of Maryland, Dr. Suntha, I should say. I saw him recently working, and I just feel like he's swimming underwater for this huge distance, and then there'll be an occasional buoy that he can come up and pop up to.
Exactly.
It sounds exactly what you for you. It's that, saving somebody's home. That's a big buoy, gives you a big breath, and then you go back in the water and
absolutely
start swimming deep again, man. Thank you for doing it. What about the legislature? You guys are coming into the session. I guess this podcast will be our launch for the 2022 session. talk to me about what that's walking in, what you're walking into as the state senator. I understand the House, their hearings are going to be virtual, but so far, and we might want to timestamp this, but so far, what are you hearing as far as what the logistical safety public health rubric is going to be for you serving in the Senate this year?
Sure. Well, you know, we have heard now, you know, President Ferguson did put out some guidance to us for what the first 30 days at least will look like. And they will be, you know, paying attention, close attention to health protocols. But the Senate, at least itself, we will be in person. We will be in session. When we are on the floor, we'll still obviously pay very close attention to masking. We'll pay very close attention to as many people as possible being vaccinated and tested as well to be safe. We try to keep people as safe as possible. But in that first 30 days, the Senate president is proposing that the hearings be virtual, that we, you know, it's a challenge. It's not the desired state. The desired state is to have the people's work open to the people, but you have to also just look at the reality of this public health crisis. And so that is the plan, and that perhaps at the 30-day point, we may be able to transition into a more in-person public hearings and process. So that is actually the plan. We are aware that the intent is to do that. As I know you know, things can change depending on what occurs, but that is the plan.
Do you think that you know, you've seen a couple of these sort of normal sessions, and then you've back to back, you're going to have some strange sessions, or maybe you have, do you think that the online experience is opening up the government to people? Because, you know, I thought my side of the legislative world was going to be totally shut down, sort of the communicating amongst the government officials and the lobbyists. And I just find it migrates to different places. And it seems to have, at least in my world, exponentially grown. This podcast is an example. Never had a podcast before the pandemic. Have this now, you know, we got thousands of people that listen to this thing, and I would have been happy having 10 people at the end of Mick O'Shea's in North Baltimore, downtown Baltimore there on any given Friday to listen to me for 2 minutes. And so to be able to bring, you know, a senator from the 47th district to talk for 30 minutes to, you know, a couple thousand people is pretty awesome. Is any of that translating in your world, or is the virtual nature an obstruction?
I wouldn't say that it is necessarily an obstruction. What I would share with you is that our committee hearings were already streamed. They were already online prior to the pandemic. What has been different has been having people basically do it via Zoom, similar to what we're doing now. But it was already the floor of the Senate and the House also is now fully equipped for those to be streamed as well. And that's been new. It wasn't that way for me just in my very, you know, first 2 years in the Senate. We did not have the cameras on the floor of the Senate. We did have it for our committee sessions. The one thing that I will share with you, though, for me, Damien, about that, though, that sometimes I do worry that it may lead to people playing more to the camera and not as much just staying on the important work that we're doing. And because you now, you know, you have a different audience, let's say. And that I don't, I you know, we have important work to do. And it is also, as you well know, it's sausage making, right? So we need to be able to have honest interactions and conversations to come to consensus on things. And so if you've got this, if you're got this outside thing that you're is in the back of your mind, that might create a little bit of a barrier to that. That I do worry about that.
Yeah, it seemed like the Mako experience. I'm a big fan of the Conduit Street podcast. You should do an intro for those folks if you haven't already. But that's sort of the cliff notes to governance sometimes in Maryland, that podcast. They talked about the Mako experience being really connective this year, the winter Mako. And it was nice to have some of those convening moments that you can be a little more efficient in the legislative world, I imagine, when you have those people right there. But I'm sure you're finding a way to do it here on your iPhone or what have you. Talk to me about how this experience, you got a young family, right? Talk to me how this whole experience has impacted them. And then I'll make you feel better by just saying that my kids were here for virtual school. And so they got to hear a number of my conference calls in the year 2021. And there is not a rosary long enough for me to repent for my mouth and my shouting and my lack of courtesy. And my daughters came down the steps and they said, "Dad, I think all you do is wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning and start yelling at people."
Right. That's
so they said, "You got to work on your tone, Dad. You got to work on your tone." So any takeaways your young kids are giving you through this experience?
You know, all I would say is my kids are just tremendously resilient. They, you know, and they too, Damien, you know, I am so grateful for this public service. Truly, I am. I just feel so blessed to be able to do it. There is a cost, though, quite honestly. And, you know, my kids are a part of that, their dad is, like you were just talking about, like you're engaged in a lot of different things. And
you got a nice tone, though, Senator. You have a nice tone.
Was that my tone? Yeah, well... until I don't, that's what
I'll stay away say, from that, I mean? Senator.
yeah, thank you. Right. Yeah. So, but they have had to be resilient, as have all kids in this very challenging last 2 years. I mean, it's just really been really, really hard on everybody. It's why I think it's so critical for everybody to just pay attention to their mental health. It's been an area that I've worked on and I've concentrated on in the General Assembly. And
I thank you for doing it because it normalizes, even if I do it in a joking, self-deprecating way that hides the anguish that a lot of people go through with behavioral health issues, just for you being at the level you are and letting it roll off the tongue as, you know, relevantly as you do, man, it brings out hope for a lot of us just to be able to talk about it and share about it. Cause you know, any issue you have, the first thing you'd love to do is find your closest friend and dump it all over them, you know? And so in your own way, in the legislative context, you're doing that. You're just opening the door to people to really express their problems. And then, you know, you can't find the solutions if you don't know the problem. So thank you with what you did with the 2-1-1 and all that stuff. I wonder if the blueprint for education and the Kerwin Commission report, like you all worked so hard to pass that, override a veto, overcome the dark money campaign against education. That was a new one to me. You overcame all of that and then boom, the pandemic. And you almost wonder, like, is that thing in date? Obviously it's needed more than ever, but you wonder, you know, were we able to put as much as we needed in there, especially in the areas of behavioral health or school clinics?
Well, there have been some real investments in behavioral health and wraparound services, which I think will absolutely pay dividends. Now, this has just been an unprecedented time for our entire education community that it's just going to take a long time to recover. And we just going to have to care for each other along the way. So I definitely feel like we will need to still make more investments. It's important for us to just really be aware of what our priorities are. And we have to just make sure that people know that it is a priority. Damien, I wanted to go back though to something that you said though about just even talking about behavioral health. And I just wanted to say to you that one of the things that really got me into working in this space is stigma, the stigma associated with talking about your behavioral health or people in general talking about their behavioral health. And I'm grateful to hear you say what you said, because I've been searching for 3 years now, going on the fourth, to try to find some legislative remedy for the stigma that is out there in our communities around behavoral health. I haven't found it yet.
I'm still looking. Are all the wrong ones. You know, I carried a stigma for my dad. I mean, I would thought I was pretty tough about it, or think I'm pretty tough about it, but my dad has passed, but he's paranoid schizophrenic, as we've talked about before, and a wonderful human being, awesome poet. It was a different lifestyle for all of us. And I feel like my whole life I've been trying to, whether it's working for the Senate of Maryland or being a member of a certain, you know, fancy club, or, you know, wearing the right kind of uniform around the people I work with. It's all a way to offset that very traumatic experience I had as a kid, just trying to figure out how I fit in. I became such an expert at fitting in that I lost myself in the process, which creates a whole nother set of behavioral health issues. So there you go. You got more out of me. I don't know, but I'm very grateful for it.
Well, listen, I'm working on continuing to work on adverse childhood experiences and working very hard, very diligently to cut those in half. I mean, it's a goal that the state of California has set, which was to cut adverse childhood experiences in half in a generation. We haven't taken that on here in Maryland, but Damien, you know, I mean, for me, that's what it's all about. Like, you know, it's allowing for folks to live their full potential and to overcome. There's great news, though. I mean, we can overcome some of these adverse childhood experiences. It does create actual neurological changes in your body and in your brain when you're facing those tough times. But there's good news, because they can be counteracted. Positive relationships can counteract it, and getting folks into environments that are nurturing actually can change the chemistry of some of our folks, you know, their brains, and break this intergenerational cycle that's out there. I mean, I could get talking deep on that with you, like, again, that is the work. It's a space that I have felt is important, because it works its way through. It does not take away from work that we may do with people who have made some mistakes and maybe have gotten in trouble with the law or anything else. But I'm trying to help people before that even happens. I don't want that to happen. You know, let's try to break these cycles with folks early. And those aren't easy investments. People don't want to make it. It's harder to get folks to prioritize that. That's the challenge for me. That's the work for me that I really do concentrate on. And I feel that it's a place where I can really make a contribution to the state.
That's a thing where not only deeds like you're achieving in the legislature and putting more money into resources and wraparound services, but just the conversation changes the culture a little bit by little bit. If I think in my context of what it was like to be, you know, a white male professional in the greater Baltimore area, thinking about issues in the public for crime. Policing is always an issue, right? And it's literally the same conversation. And, you know, suburbanites have a sort of a damning view of what's going on in the city. And I was at, you know, a very fancy, prestigious club that's supposed to be sort of used to be thought of as disconnected from all this stuff. And I'm having lunch with a guy and he's talking about trauma-informed care. And he's talking about, he's not talking about throwing people in jail. He's talking about, you know, 10 years before, how can we invest in measures that are going to, you know, give a chance of a person to chance to reset in that trauma scenario. And so I do feel like the conversation makes it culturally cool to explore, or just culturally critical to explore these sorts of solutions and getting invested earlier. Is there something, anything we should be looking at? And I'll let you go soon, but is there anything I should be looking at in the legislature for this session in that space that that I should keep an eye on, a bill or a measure?
Well, I will. You know, I'm also just a big data person. And so we're also just going to be, you know, continuing. Last session, I had a piece of legislation that helped us to gather the data around adverse childhood experiences amongst our youth. There's a survey that is done and making sure that we're asking questions about that. I'm going to now ask that same thing around the behavioral survey that we do amongst our adults. We have to know what our issues are, and we got to have that consistently over time in order for us to be able to really work on them. So I'm going to be working on that in that
space. You got to know what you're dealing with first, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's what that is. I am a part of, as you talked about, there is a trauma-informed care commission. I am the Senate representative on that. We are getting our sea legs under.
Is Zico on that at all? He's a Baltimore City councilman. Have you? Yeah.
Exactly right. That's correct. He's on it. He presented at our meeting, the last meeting that we had. And so we're, you know, there is real energy there. And I'm hopeful that we'll have some things coming out from that in that space. You know, and we'll just keep plugging away day by day.
Well, Senator, I'd love to offer up some platitudes and kindnesses, but the best thing I could do is just let you talk. Just let you talk and lead. So I just want to thank you for joining us on the lobby, and I'm looking forward to seeing you online, and maybe you, me, and Zeke Cohen will do a little New Carrollton to Baltimore Penn Station little train trip there and see what's going on in each other's community.
That would be fantastic. I look forward to it. I'm really appreciative of you giving me a chance to talk to you today about these things that I just, you know, they're dear to my heart. And thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Senator.
All right.
Great having you on.